The U.S. intends to rule the world by force and to do it permanently. Any potential challenge that is detected to U.S. dominance will be destroyed.
The more the government says, just trust us, the less we feel inclined to do so.
We've found clearly that the Iraqi environment is under extraordinary stress and has been so for quite some years.
What we expect is to see really improvement on the ground for the people in terms of better provision of water, electricity, and medical care. And it's taking time.
The father of the president needs to recuse himself from the Carlyle Group because of the conflicts of interest, and that we see that through this war profiteering, you see an undermining of the credibility in government.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, May 29th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, one of the architects of the invasion of Iraq, is in Basra today, lauding British troops occupying a former palace of Saddam Hussein's for helping to create what Blair called a defining moment in history. Blair gambled his premiership backing the American-led invasion of Iraq, told the British troops, quote, "There were a lot of disagreements in the country over the wisdom of my decision to order the action, but I can assure you of one thing. There's absolutely no dispute in Britain at all about your professionalism, your courage, and your dedication." But the political battle continues for the prime minister, who faces fresh new controversy back at home over the lack of proof for his allegations that Saddam Hussein harbored weapons of mass destruction, the main justification used by London and Washington to invade Iraq. Blair met with U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, who briefed him on economic problems, crime, remaining Ba'ath Party members, and growing concern on the part of the U.S. and Britain over Shiite Islamism and Iran's support for it. Although U.S. forces have taken control of the daily operations of Baghdad's social and municipal services, progress is still going slower than planned in many parts of the city, with post-war reconstruction and political reorganization expected to take months, if not years. Aaron Glantz reports from Baghdad.
The turbines still turn some of the time at the Al-Wetba water treatment plant on the banks of the Tigris River in northern Baghdad. The director of the plant, Mohandas Qasim Mohammed Ali, says it's only cleaning water at half its pre-war output. There's not enough electricity to run the turbines all the time, he says. There aren't any spare parts. But even if there were, the plant might still be running at half capacity. Mohandas says it's getting harder for him to get his workers to show up, since most of them aren't being paid.
We told the coalition forces that people here need salaries. Most of the workers here haven't received any money for 3 months. Since the start of the war, the only money they've received has been one payment of $20 from the Americans. It's hard to get workers to show up when they're not being paid.
Because Saddam Hussein's government was a socialist one, most of the people in Iraq worked for the government, even those not providing essential services like water. So with Saddam Hussein's government gone, most working-class Iraqis sit at home all day without pay. Before the war, Jassim Farhan worked in a government cigarette factory. But at 11 o'clock in the morning, he's at home with his wife and his daughter. He's just received $20 from the American Army, his first paycheck in 3 months. He doesn't know when his next paycheck will come, but he's optimistic because the American Army has fired his old Ba'athist boss and allowed the workers to pick a new manager from amongst their own ranks through an election.
The city was destroyed and burned. It's not easy to fix. We must give Bush more time. In front of the whole world, Bush said he wanted democracy for us. Now he must prove this, and I think he will prove this, but he needs time. You know, Saddam was very, very, very bad, and no one who comes to Iraq will be bad like him.
In the meantime, though, things are getting more difficult every day for Jassim and his family. His family is unable to pay the rent on their small apartment. His 9-year-old daughter doesn't go to school. Instead, she stays home all day because the streets of Baghdad are filled with looters and thieves. In the downstairs apartment, it's a similar story. All the men in this apartment are out looking for jobs. The women are at home because the streets are too dangerous. Nasreen Ali worked as a nurse before the war.
If I go to the market or on a walk or to the hospital, I'm afraid. I feel that they will try to kidnap me. I won't go to work because there's no safety. Every time I go outside, they try to steal from me. There's no security. No security.
Like many Iraqis, Nasreen Ali dreams of a better life abroad. She's placed a giant picture of San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge on the wall of her living room. The nurse says there's nothing left for her in Baghdad, so she's trying to leave Iraq for California, where she would work at her cousin's convenience store. But the American government hasn't approved her immigration papers. She asks me to take a message to her cousin when I return to California. Please tell him not to give up, she tells me. I want to leave this place and come to America. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
A U.S. Army colonel in charge of inspecting key sites in Baghdad says the bunker that the U.S. said it bombed on the opening night of the Iraq war in a bid to kill Saddam Hussein never existed. Quoted on CBS Evening News, Colonel Tim Medeer said no trace of a bunker of bodies had been found at the site known as Dora Farms. According to the network, both the CIA and Colonel Medeer searched the area twice, hoping to find traces of DNA that might indicate whether Saddam Hussein or his sons had been killed. On the night of the attack, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told reporters, quote, there's no question but that the strike on that leadership headquarters was successful. We have photographs of what took place, end quote. The fate of Saddam Hussein and his sons remains unclear. 15,000 Arabs have been displaced by Kurdish fighters in southern Iraq, according to Reuters News. When the Ba'ath regime initially fell, Kurdish fighters invaded the village of Kanaquin and gave the families 48 hours to evacuate. Many of those families from Kanaquin are now living in the abandoned Khanbani Sayyad prison, 30 miles north of Baghdad. The Times UK reports that, quote, now Khanbani Sayyad prison, overlooked by watchtowers and surrounded by razor wire, is filled with families who are victims not of the war but of the peace, end quote. Peace Watch editor Lona Elias spoke earlier today with Nada Dumani, the International Committee of the Red Cross spokesperson in Baghdad, about the present humanitarian conditions in Iraq and the issue of the displaced families.
In these areas in the north, which are close to what used to be known as the Iraqi Kurdistan, there are a few villages from which people have been displaced. These are Arabs who have been displaced by armed Kurdish people. And I don't know, a few hundreds or a few thousand maybe have been displaced from their houses. Most of them have come in the 70s or in the 80s. They come from the southern part of Iraq and have already been displaced from this part. And now they're living in different houses, not living under tents or in camps, but they're living with some people, and the International Red Cross is trying to assess their situation and try to provide them with some assistance in order for them to cope with the new situation. Moreover, in Baghdad, there are a few hundred families of Palestinians who also have been displaced from their houses. They used to live, most of them used to live in houses rented by the previous Iraqi government. And now the owners of these houses came back, or they have been also, in a way, forced to leave their houses.
In this report, they say that families are forced to live in Khanbani Sa'ad prison. Have you heard about that? They said this particular family, the mother of six and three daughters, are living in a cell in one of the prisons. Have you heard about that, that this particular prison is being used?
No, I can't confirm that. No, honestly, I cannot confirm that. We cannot confirm this information.
What is the incidences of dysentery and other diseases from the water situation over there, the lack of clean water?
Yes, we have to be accurate concerning all these stories about diarrhea and dysentery, especially concerning children. It's endemic in Iraq in any case, and especially with temperature soaring now, it's very often, I mean, every year you have cases like this. Now, water as such, water coming from the water station, water treatment stations in Baghdad, for instance, is not bad in terms of quality. And I can say that because our engineers, Red Cross engineers and technicians of the water board are working regularly on these water treatment plants. The problems come The problems come especially when you have this water, the provision of water. Some water pipes have leaks. There is also shortage of water in some areas of the capital, for instance, and people would resort to any kind of water they would find, even polluted water. And the problem also is that the whole health system has less capacities than before to cope with new cases or more cases. As you know, hospitals are not functioning as they used to, and medical care is not provided as well as it used to be provided. So it makes these cases a little bit more difficult to be taken care of.
The last time we spoke, there were a number of incidents of people coming in still with injuries from unexploded cluster bombs and other ordinances that have been found in the city. Are there still incidences of that? Are you still getting reports about people coming in that have been wounded in this
one? Yes, absolutely. I think all these places haven't been cleared yet. There are still armored vehicle, ammunition stockpiles, as you mentioned, cluster bombs, all kinds of unexploded ordnance which are still in the country and haven't been cleared yet. Apparently, coalition forces are trying to clear them, but the number is quite huge and it would take some time before they are cleared. On our side, we're trying really to launch and extend our awareness campaign, especially to children, in order to make them aware of these danger and these threats. But there are still incidents reported.
What type of numbers are you seeing in terms of injuries or hearing about?
Well, so far, we don't have a global view because there is no centralized information bureau or statistical bureau that keeps statistics on the incidents. And information doesn't circulate very well. As you know, also telecommunications don't work in Iraq inside the country. So we can hardly have an overview of the number of incidents. But for sure, we can say that daily you have cases of people injured by unexploded ordnance, explosive remnants of war.
How is the development going in terms of the telephone services there? How are they doing in terms of restoring the phone services?
Unfortunately, it isn't better now than it used to be a few weeks ago, meaning that still there is no telephone communication in Iraq, inside the country. We can talk now because we are privileged and we have a satellite phone, but there are no phones inside Iraq. You can have find some very specific in areas in Baghdad where people can call each other within the same small area, but phones are not functioning yet. People still rely on satellite phones, and they have to pay a lot of money for that.
Recently, they changed the civil administrator from Jay Gardner to Paul Bremer. And I'm wondering, has your organization seen any improvement, or what is the situation like in terms of your ability to do what you need to do in cooperation with the civil administration?
Well, you know, we do have, in any case, regular meetings at all levels with the U.S. civil administration now, be it headed by Paul Bremer or by Jay Gardner. What we expect is to see really improvement on the ground for the people in terms of better provision of water, electricity, and medical care. And it's taking time.
Okay. Nada, any final thoughts?
We have started visiting detainees in Baghdad region, and that's since last Saturday. And this is new because so far we had access to Umm Qasr detention camp, but not to detainees. I don't mean POWs, I just mean all detainees in Baghdad region, and that's a good point too.
What are the conditions like for the people who are being detained?
Yeah, well, as you probably know, the ICRC refrains from commenting publicly on conditions of detention. We think it's good that we do have access. Now, my colleagues are visiting regularly these detainees in order to monitor their conditions of detention and also to ensure that they can communicate with their families through Red Cross messages, which was not possible so far.
I am somewhat surprised that you hesitate to publicly comment on the conditions, because I would suppose that part of the reason that you're there in terms of providing a public service, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is so that you can disseminate this information widely. So I'm surprised that you would hesitate to actually go public with what the conditions are.
No, you shouldn't be surprised. That's a standard position of the ICRC. Everywhere in the world, you would never see the ICRC commenting publicly on conditions of detention. That has nothing to do with Iraq. We never comment on condition of detention, and that doesn't mean that they are bad or they're good. Just we don't. And if we have any remarks or recommendation, we do them on a bilateral basis to the detaining authorities. That's the way we always proceed everywhere in the world.
Nada Dumani is the official spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Baghdad, Iraq. She spoke with Peace Watch editor Lona Elias. The United Nations has sounded alarm bells over the severe environmental damage in Iraq, which could slow humanitarian efforts and the long-term recovery of the country. As Swiss Radio International Anna Nelson reports, a Swiss-backed study has revealed that decades of war and government mismanagement have caused serious environmental problems, putting civilians and aid workers at risk.
The evaluation of Iraq's environment was conducted by the UN Environment Program, or UNEP, and financed by the Swiss government, based on a humanitarian initiative by the foreign minister, Micheline Camiret, in February. The aim of the study was to evaluate the environmental hazards in post-war Iraq, as well as to outline an immediate strategy for protecting civilians and aid workers. What they found was alarming. From destroyed and inadequate water and sewage systems to the presence of toxic and radioactive substances and military waste, not to mention polluted rivers and marshlands. According to Michael Williams, the UNEP's chief spokesman, the damage is the result of both the recent conflict and a quarter century of neglect and abuse.
We've found clearly that the Iraqi environment is under extraordinary stress and has been so for quite some years. This is due to a variety of conflicts that we have seen, the Iran-Iraq War, the 1991 Gulf War, you have the sanctions then in the 1990s, and you've had the most recent conflict. On top of all that, quite a bit of environmental mismanagement by the previous regime.
The report stresses the need to restore the country's water and sanitation systems and to clean up pollution hotspots and waste sites in order to reduce the risk of disease epidemics and allow humanitarian workers to get aid into the country. But Williams says it's also essential to come up with a long-term recovery plan that will protect Iraq's environment in the future.
Over the longer term, there's a great deal of work to be done in reviving Iraq's infrastructure, in reviving the Mesopotamian marshlands and much of the natural environment. It's very important that when people look at the rehabilitation and reconstruction of the country over years and decades, that for these environmental issues be incorporated into any such strategies. Because again, the health of the environment will have an immense impact on the health of society and of the economy and is of great value to human beings.
Making this happen won't be easy and will involve not only the help of international organizations and governments, but also the building of strong national institutions to allow the Iraqi people to become responsible for their own environment, in the hope that the next quarter century won't see the smoke of burning oil fields or bombs blacken Iraqi skies again. Reporting from Geneva, this is Anna Nelson.
In a recent commentary on Peace Watch, Jay Bookman, deputy editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, notes that the concept of America as a world empire, so controversial as to be almost unsayable just a few months ago, is now close to conventional wisdom. Since waging a unilateral war on Iraq without seeking renewed UN backing, this notion of empire has been adopted by the right wing and mentioned on the op-ed pages of major newspapers across the country. But in the public view, these empirical plans have been achieved by scaring the American populace into believing it's facing an imminent external threat and then countering those supposed threats with an overwhelming display of military force, as was the case with Iraq, and as may soon be the case in Iran, Syria, or North Korea. That's according to MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky, who says that the ultimate goal of such force is to maintain U.S. political and economic dominance in the Middle East and throughout the rest of the world. He spoke recently at the Agape International Spiritual Center in Los Angeles.
The U.S. intends to rule the world by force and to do it permanently. any potential challenge that is detected to U.S. dominance will be destroyed. That's the content of the national security strategy. It's been nothing like that in history. Nobody's ever said that. They may think it, you know, or they may describe policy that way, in fact have, but it's never been declared as official government policy before. There are precedents, and they're worth looking at, but nothing quite like this. Well, that frightened people, increased the fear that already existed. The fear was already great, increased it greatly. This is sometimes called a preemptive war doctrine. That's just propaganda. It's not a preemptive war doctrine. Preemptive war means something. A preemptive war, under charitable interpretations, falls within the existing framework of international law. Okay, so you, those of you whose memories are long enough may remember that the present incumbents in Washington, one of the ways they kept the country terrified through the 1980s, as they did, one of them was to conjure up an air base in Grenada, which the Russians were going to use to bomb us. You know, fortunately, our brave cowboy leader saved us in time, sent 6,000 special forces who managed to overcome the resistance of a couple of dozen Cuban paramilitary workers with pistols, and actually got 8,000 medals of honor for it. And we were standing tall after that, if you remember. So we were saved. But for a while, it looked like the Russians were going to bomb us from Grenada, assuming they could find it on a map somewhere. Well, suppose they found it, and they had bombers there. And the bombers in Grenada were doing just what we were told they were going to do when everyone was supposed to be shivering. They were coming across the Caribbean to bomb Florida. Okay, if at that point the U.S. sent out planes to shoot down the bombers before they destroyed us, that would be legitimate under Article 51 of the UN Charter. That's preemptive war. Now, this is something totally different. This is a doctrine that says we will attack anyone who we regard as a potential challenge. Nothing preemptive about that. Sometimes it's called preventive war, but that's not right either. It's not preventing anything. The only thing it's preventing is any potential challenge that the U.S. government invents, claims to be a challenge. That's just an open license to go to war with anybody and destroy anybody, which we can do because we have overwhelming power. And that's the way it's understood, and that doesn't make people comfortable. It caused a wave of hatred and fear. This is, I think this is the most feared and hated political leadership maybe in history. It's hard to think of it. Not okay. Well, that's one thing that happened in September. Another thing that happened in September was the opening of the midterm election campaign. September was the opening of the campaign for the congressional elections. Well, the Republicans understood very well that they can't possibly win the elections if the issues are those that concern people, socioeconomic issues, basically. And the reason is they're cutting everybody's throat, and they'll get smashed if that's the issue. So they had to do what they did right through the 1980s. Through the 1980s, their policies were extremely unpopular. They were able to stay in for good reason. They were able to stay in office by frightening people, and that's what they did again. Karl Rove just was kind enough yesterday in the New York Times to explain it, although it was obvious before. It was necessary to frighten people into believing that there's a threat to their security. In that case, they'll rally around the strong leader, the brave cowboy, another one. And they'll suppress their concerns over things like, where's my job, or what's happening to my pension, or how am I going to take care of my elderly mother, and so on and so forth. They're voting on those issues. The administration doesn't have a chance. And as Rove just pointed out yesterday, if they want to pursue their domestic agenda, a very harsh agenda, which would change the return the country back to, 100 years ago. If they want to do that, they're going to have to frighten people. And that's correct. And they did. Starting in September, there was a drumbeat of propaganda about several things. First, that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to our survival, just like Grenada in 1983, an imminent threat to our survival. Another was the constant insinuation that he was behind, he carried out or organized the September 11th attacks, and that they were planning new ones. Well, this was a spectacularly successful government media propaganda campaign. You can see it by looking at the polls. By the end of September and since, around 60% of the population believes that Saddam Hussein is a imminent threat to U.S. security and survival. By now, over a majority think that Iraq was behind September 11th and is planning new things, that Iraqis were on the planes. If you go back before that, it was like 3%. And furthermore, these attitudes, these beliefs, are very highly correlated with support for war. And it's understandable. I mean, if I believed those things, I'd be in favor of the war, too. You know, if you think that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to your existence, that he carried out the September 11th attacks, he's powerful enough to carry out new ones, yeah, there's an argument for war. And people in the United States are genuinely frightened. This is unique to the United States. No one else believes any of this. Even the neighboring countries that were attacked by Saddam Hussein is considered insane. But here it dominates. It did work for the election, barely. The Republicans managed to maintain power to pursue their domestic and international agendas by a very small number of votes, a couple of tens of thousands of votes. It was essentially a statistical tie, but just enough to maintain power. And they did it exactly this way. Polls show that people maintained their preferences but suppressed their concerns over issues that matter in your life because they suppressed it below the security threat, so you rally around the leader. This is the story that went right through the 1980s. For these guys in office, it is absolutely second nature.
That was professor and author Noam Chomsky speaking in Los Angeles. Thanks to Giovanni D. Simone and David Adelson for production assistance with that piece.
And if I was the president, this is George W. Bush, the minute the Congress called my name, the President of the United States. I say now, who do you think you're fooling? At this moment, the regime of Saddam Hussein is being removed from power. American and coalition forces are now operating the government of Iraq so that Iraqi security, your great religious traditions, your government, your all, your rights, your food and water and medicine, and the future of your country belong to the United States. Our military forces will not stop inside Baghdad. We will go forward with brutal compassion, whose peaceful aggression and weapons of mass destruction free all the people who make up your country. And then our military forces will go forward. We will free all the good and gifted people in the world from sovereign nations and enemy regimes. And the future of all of the countries in the world will soon belong to the United States. Your nations will soon be free.
The Christmas Coup Comedy Players, produced by Pacifica Stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.